Good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I'm calling this meeting of the committee to order. Welcome, members and members of the public. This meeting is being called pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows virtual meetings of this type to be held. Meeting materials, members of the public, are posted on our committee website, which you can find at the House website under Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. They've also been sent out to members of the committee and to staff. And so with that, speaking of members, we'll begin with the call of the roll. Ms. Chambers, if you can do that.
Yes, Representative Pinto, chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, vice chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damith.
Present.
Representative Juergens. Representative
Juergens present.
Representative Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wazlowick.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott present.
All right, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. Our minutes of the meeting of February 4th have been posted. I can ask our Vice Chair, Representative Pryor, to move approval of those minutes.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And any additions or corrections from members to those minutes? We'll give just a second to see. Not hearing anything. So all in favor of approval of the February 4th minutes, please say aye.
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 Thank you. Any opposed? Okay, with that, the motion passes. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. And so members and members of the public, the plan this week, plan for today is to hear from Department of Human Services on two important topics. One is to just continue, and we're really wrapping this up, laying the foundation of knowledge for members of the committee and others as well on the important topics that the committee oversees, and we'll be hearing about the licensing of childcare and regulation of that. And then also another important topic, you remember that in 2020, about a year ago, we heard updates about some program integrity measures that the legislature passed in 2019 relating to the childcare assistance program. And had, I think, a really good conversation a year ago, and that seemed important to then hear a further update about what's going on with that. One more year on, and that'll be the second half of the morning. And then we'll move on from there. And I'll talk a little bit at the very end about what's coming up after that. So with that, we're going to get going with the presentation from Department of Human Services. I believe that Ms. Wagner is up. Great. And so we'll have you identify yourself for the record if you can. And so members, the plan again is to kind of lay a foundation for us of knowledge, and we can ask some questions and then do the second half as well. So Ms. Wagner, please identify yourself and begin.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Reggie Wagner, and I oversee the licensing division at the Department of Human Services, and childcare licensing is one of the areas that we oversee and regulate. So I'm going to just share my screen here. Let's go with this one. All right, I think you have the slide on the PowerPoint. Okay, great, thank you so much. So what I want to do, and I know that we have some time constraints, so I'm not going to necessarily read everything that's on our slides here. Let's see how we do. Okay, great. But I wanted to make sure that there was some additional information for members in the event that we maybe don't get to it, or anybody needs us to follow up on anything in the future. So what we want to present is just sort of a high level overview, talking about the role of licensing and ensuring the health and safety and the well-being of children in care. Generally, we can talk about four high level categories that many of the rules and standards and requirements fall into. Things related to health, safety, ratio, some training, some of the physical standards. Again, they are they're non-residential programs, but they're clearly done in some level of a setting or facility. And depending on whether it's a childcare center or an in-home family provider, those settings look different, but there still are some physical standards that each of those rules regulate. And then also just at a not going into great detail, but just reminding everybody that there are background study requirements. And then as you can see the rules down here, Chapter 245A is the Human Services Licensing Act, and that covers a range of our child care services and other licensed services. And then we have a separate Rule 2, what we call Rule 2 for Family Child Care, 9502, and Rule 3 for our child care centers. So we always start off with who needs a license, because we do allow in Minnesota, as other states do, but in varying categories, if you will, what are the conditions and circumstances under which somebody would need a license. And so in general, if you're going to care for children from more than one unrelated family, you will need a license, whether that's a in-home family child care, whether that is a child care center, that can vary, but the threshold for that remains the same. So we always try to make clear that if you have your own children, and that's defined within statute about what it means for related children, and you want to care for your neighbor's children, you don't need a license to do that. If you want to care for your neighbor on the north side and your neighbor on the south side of the block, more than one unrelated family, then that would trigger needing a license. And so we just think that that's really important. Our providers are adhering to these minimum health and safety, and obviously they go beyond that. And so having people in our formal regulatory framework is very, very important. And it really acknowledges the hard work that our providers are doing. So as I've mentioned, it can vary based upon the location and the setting. But then generally, family child care in someone's own home is by statute limited to no more than 14. Just making sure I'm advancing the slides correctly here. We do have a new category of what we call a certified child care center. And so in Chapter 245A, Minnesota statutes, there are numerous, perhaps as many as 27 exclusions from licensure. Oftentimes it's because a program may be licensed or overseen by, in whole or in part by, say, the Department of Health, or perhaps the Department of Corrections, or there are some other statutory carve-outs in which some level of unlicensed care is okay. However, with some changes at the federal level since the Child Care Reauthorization Act of 2014 was enacted, certain, even if they are unlicensed or what we call license exempt under Minnesota law, would still need to meet some basic health and safety standards and have an annual inspection if they want to serve families that are eligible for and participating in our child care assistance program. So that's a little bit of a difference, and it's tied to the ongoing payment of that. So it's voluntary for a program. Since we've implemented, we have had about roughly 600, I think right now we're at 583. And again, this provides a great deal of choice for families in the child care assistance program. And it's also, again, programs that are otherwise exempt, having kind of a certification, which some people say a little bit is a little bit licensing light. And we did develop the standards in consultation with a stakeholder group of those programs. So at a very high level, we want to make sure people understand is that for child care, our work is a little bit different. And as you can see from the slide on the left, when we talk about child care centers, those are sometimes what we call the directly licensed, meaning DHS staff are the ones that kind of work on those applications, ultimately do the pre-licensing visit, carry the caseload, respond to the complaints, and go out and do the on-site licensing work and any follow-up technical assistance. And so those are, quote, my staff. They report to me through my managers. And as of January of this year, we had 1,752 licensed centers across the state. Family child care is licensed differently under a particular statute in Minnesota and rule, statutes 245A16. We have what's called a delegated structure by which the counties play a significant role in the licensing, and the role of the state is limited to sort of those more important things about approving or denying the license, taking recommendation from the county about issuing fines, conditionals, and revocations. The bulk of that licensing work, the application, the on-site visits, the issuing of correction orders is done by county staff, county licensors, and then we kind of oversee the counties in ensuring that the visits are done. We've been really working the last few years to respond to concerns about consistency and quality and level of training and communication. So that's just to make sure that people understand our role in the in-home family child care, as well as in-home child foster care and adult foster care, relies in great part upon the work that our county licensors do. So just going to call out very, very high level here, maybe some key things related to the health and safety, the group size, and the ratio. So this list that you have on this slide is really a summary. We think that the federal law from a few years ago, trying to get states to have not necessarily the same policy, but to make sure that all of their child care rules and regulations cover these set, I believe it's 12 here, categories. And so at the time, Minnesota had many of these already addressed in our statute. We did not have to make significant changes to come into compliance on these issues. But I think this gives you a pretty good idea of what each state is now required to have policies specific to the category. So it might look a little bit different for family versus, in-home family versus center. The other thing that's really important to understand is that there is a need for the group size and the ratio, right? I mean, how many children can be with with a caregiver based upon the age and the mix? It can be a little bit complicated. When I say, centers average about maybe 70 as a capacity, what you really don't know is how many infants can they care for? How many toddlers can they care for? How many preschool? With an in-home family provider, they may have a capacity maximum of 14 with two caregivers. The average for one caregiver is a capacity of 10. What you don't really know is, well, at any given time, how many infants or toddlers do they have? And so that kind of mix, particularly for an in-home family provider, there's a lot of flexibility and fluidity, but it also makes it a little bit challenging to confidently say, each provider is caring for X number. It's very dependent upon their model and upon how they're running their business. But the state does have some clear, and you're going to see this. So like on this page here for family childcare, we have basically up to 7 different types of classes or licenses in family childcare. And again, it can vary. If you take the more infants and toddlers you take, the fewer preschoolers in there, right? The more you have some preschoolers. So it's kind of a little mix to allow for adequate supervision and caregiving. Within centers, the ratios are a little bit more kind of cut and dried. If it's infant, it's one caregiver for every 4 infants. They may be able to use aides, but there also needs to be the formal teacher qualified. That doesn't mean a teacher is in like a school setting, but a teacher qualified. So this gives you a sense of what the group sizes are. And clearly, as the children go older, the group sizes can be larger. Children can be a little bit more independent. They can be responding more to some of the verbal cues and engagement. And so this sort of reflects that as well.
Ms. Wager, can I ask you a real quick question back on the last slide? The maximum group size, so if there are 3 or 4 teachers in a room, does that mean, like on infants, does that mean that, what does the maximum group size of like 8 infants mean? I'm thinking back to my own kids being in the they were in a center at the
yep.
time.
That would generally be within that classroom. We often do talk in centers about within the classroom. So again, there's going to be, size limitations as well, but at some point, they don't want the group size to be too big, so you might have to space out the groupings of the infants.
Okay, good, thank you, that's helpful. Yeah.
So caregiver training and qualifications, again, it can vary depending upon whether it's a center or a family. The centers have a little bit more of those requirements for training. There does need to be a teacher qualified, but our rule and statute allow for up to 9 different ways to get a designation of teacher qualified. We often give variances from a particular rule requirement for centers. It's a really helpful way for a center to perhaps bring somebody on who maybe doesn't have all of the on-site training hours working in a program, but they'll get them in the next 6 months by being there. So we might work with a center to really come up with an individualized plan to help maintain that workforce and be able to get folks in and get them teacher qualified. So the standards are there. There is certainly a great deal of flexibility, but we do know that the workforce issue is significant, and we hear that from our childcare centers a great deal. They are, whether it's center staff or the in-home provider, whether they use another caregiver or substitutes, there is some ongoing training requirements. 16 hours for a family child care provider who's that primary caregiver, 16 hours annually. And for centers, it used to be as high as 40 hours, including orientation. When we made some changes a few years ago around the block grant, we actually looked at what other states were doing. We engaged with some stakeholders, and we've actually reduced that to about 24 hours of annual training. And then the orientation a little bit separate. So we felt that where Minnesota was at that time for centers was a little bit higher than what many of the other states were. And so we were able to work with some stakeholders and kind of rethink the required training. Just touching briefly on the physical standards. So again, the rules vary depending upon the setting of a formal, you know, center, a commercial setting versus an in-home residential. But in general, there are some other regulations that are not part of the Department of Human Services. We may be dependent upon a fire inspection from the fire marshal's office. And a provider may be required to make some changes based upon something the fire marshal says. Depending on the setting, there may need to be a building inspection done. And someone may need to make some changes based upon that. Usually you see that if there's been some construction in often a commercial setting. But again, I think it can be challenging to say there are licensing requirements, but they're really, you need to follow your local building code. And so that could trigger another state agency or a local official coming in. Same thing with meeting those kitchen standards from the Department of Health for a commercial kitchen. Again, if you're serving a large number of children in a childcare center, some of those food regulations are going to actually be governed by the Department of Health and not really the Department of Human Services licensing. So we kind of are the umbrella, if you will, of regulations, knowing that at different points, some providers may actually be interacting with multiple state or local officials. And then again, a high level that there are background study requirements. This is an area that a few years ago, the federal child care reauthorization did create some standardization across the states. While we've had historically a very strong and robust background study process, the feds have gone to a national criminal record check. So that would be through the FBI, fingerprint based. We are clear now that the minors ages 13 to 17 for those in-home family providers only have a name and date of birth study. So that is a place that we've had some kind of changes back in ensuring that that's only a name and date of birth. Obviously, if anybody works in a paid position that's under 17 in either a center or working in somebody's family program, then they're a staff person and they would have that more formal fingerprint study. But household members under 13 to 17 are name and date of birth. And so the slide just shows you the range of entities, whether they're, not all volunteers need to have a background study, but clearly if they're used in a way that has unsupervised access, then they would. So there's some kind of degrees in there. So just want to quickly move into licensing inspections and enforcement mechanisms. And generally, we conduct now unannounced annual inspections for childcare. Childcare is really the only one in which we have a requirement and are staffed at this point to be able to do annual, and they do need to be unannounced. We previously had been at about a 2 to 3 year mark for our centers and every 2 years for family providers. And so that has changed now as a result of getting to the requirement for the annual inspections. The licensors do go out on site. Some work can be done at the office in terms of getting some information in advance, but much of it is having physical eyes in that program and then also reviewing training records and so forth. One of the things that we are pleased about is from the 2019 legislative session, what we call for, this is specifically for child care centers, but I came to call our early and often unit. And it was a way for licensing to also have more capacity in responding to some concerns that were raised in the Office of Legislative Auditor's report around program integrity and pointing out that getting out there only at about the end of the first 12 months of operation may not really be adequate to help ensure that providers are really operating in compliance with the rules, that they really are kind of a ongoing childcare business. So we have a new unit that we have staffed up and hired and rethought some of our work actually during the first year and looking at those quarterly visits. The first one would be announced technical assistance visit, trying to really establish a good supportive relationship with that center in the very beginning, and then would be unannounced in those other quarters. We actually had begun this work pre-COVID and had started to get out and see those, and we are getting back to resuming much more of our normal work. So we'll be able to talk a little bit more about some of that in the future, but wanted to point out that that is kind of a new effort in licensing, trying to have a response and better capacity and resources in the program integrity. So we look to see whether they're in compliance with rules. We don't necessarily look at every single rule at the moment that we're out there. We may be out there doing a follow-up visit on like a correction order follow-up. We may be doing a technical assistance visit. So it can vary, but in general, we are determining the compliance with the rules and standards. These slides, I obviously won't read everything with you, and hopefully you have the set, but it gives you kind of like from the lower to the more kind of more onerous or serious, you know, what do we have in the toolbox, if you will, if there is non-compliance during the visit. So the first thing, fix-it tickets, this applies to both family child care and centers. This was something from, I think in 2017, it came from providers, particularly family child care providers. And we kind of worked with them and the legislators that were carrying this to get this to a place that we could really operationalize. And so these are for very, very minor infractions, recognizing that when the visits are unannounced and you obviously, particularly for family child care, are running your business in your home, there's going to be kind of, you know, sometimes not everything is exactly in the place it needs to be. So Fix-It Ticket was designed to begin to understand that there can be some small kind of de minimis violations that really don't impact the immediate health and safety. And then that is not a correction order if it's fixed on site or within a short period of time. But in most instances, if there is a violation determined, a correction order does issue. Usually correction orders do not carry a fine. So not every correction order equates to being fined. Some related to violations of health and safety may have a fine. And so then just briefly, the kind of maybe more escalation, if you will, is there can be fines. There can be conditional licenses based upon nature, severity, chronicity of the violations. Sometimes it's just a history of noncompliance that builds up over the repeated categories. Sometimes it's just a serious incident that reveals a lot of systemic problems with the program. Temporary immediate suspension, that is something that would allow the commissioner to temporarily cease the operation of the family child care or the center program. Usually it's in response to a very serious incident that needs to be explained a little bit more, that needs to be understood as to whether there is an ongoing risk of harm to the children. So not every serious thing that happens results in a TIS. There may be a very clear explanation of what happened. And but if there is more time that is needed and we're not sure, then it is something that we would look at. And obviously there are appeal rights through all of these things for any provider on that. Suspensions, those are very, very infrequent if it's just a pure suspension. And then a revocation, again, a revocation is if we feel that through compliance, there is just no indication that this program is able to maintain compliance with the rules and standards. And as I said, they do have appeal rights in there. They can continue to operate even under a revocation order, sometimes with some conditions, if they are in fact challenging the department's decision. There have been a few changes, some in statute, some in our process related to family child care. Again, we're really trying to hear providers and legislators and even our county licensors when we all talk about that kind of three-legged stool and that triangularized relationship between the provider, the county licensor, and then the role that DHS has. And so there is a new provision in statute that talks about, gives the ability for a license holder, a family child care license holder, to seek some clarification if they are having the licensor there on site, the licensor is explaining that they think that a condition that they see is a violation, the provider is like, no, I'm pretty sure that's not what's in the rule and that's not how it should be interpreted. So if there's a good faith disagreement, they have the ability right there, the licensor, to say, well, you know, I'm pretty sure we're going to cite you for this, but if not, and we have a form that the provider can fill out and email or fax in, even just a quick picture and send it off as an email attachment. Most people are doing those things nowadays in their business and their personal lives. And so we can get that information quickly and be able to kind of weigh in on whether we think the licensor is going in the right direction or not. So it's fairly new. We've only had, as you can see, you know, inspections are happening. They're now annual inspections. So there's probably over 7,000 inspections a year that are happening. And we've had a very, very small number of these. So, you know, in the moment, I'm sure it's very important. You know, we're going to start to look at our data. We'll understand from it. We'll see if it's certain issues that keep coming up. We're really trying to use our data to help inform our understanding of how our licensors and our county licensors in particular are doing their work and whether there's more training that we might need to engage in. So I did mention
we'll need to wrap up in just a couple minutes.
Okay, great. So let me just try to move through. We've talked a little bit. I'll give you these slides for there is a great deal of appeal time that is in there. So I won't spend a lot of time on the mechanics of it. I know that at times people are concerned that with the Office of Administrative Hearings and the administrative law judge's recommendations that the commissioner, quote, has the final say. Our data is very clear that the commissioner is almost always in step with adopting after their own review the ALJ's recommendation. But in those times when the commissioner deviates from whatever the administrative law judge might recommend, it can either be upholding a very serious sanction, particularly temporary immediate suspensions, or sometimes they actually deviate in a way that is more favorable to the provider. So I think it's important to understand that the commissioner having the final review can actually be beneficial to the health and safety of kids and to the provider at times, because they often, on occasion, can go different than the administrative law judge. So I'll leave you this other information. We have a new data collection tool that is allowing us, particularly in our county work, to get a lot more information, more real time in our own database, things that were previously at the county level. In the past, we didn't have any visibility into. It was all paper driven. We now have the ability to get this compliance information directly from the counties. Perhaps the thing I'd like to make sure that we show you is that as we began looking at our first full fiscal year of data, what we saw is that out of 6,600 visits that year, there were correction orders issued in a small number of those visits, 1,200, and those 227 are fix-it tickets. So what we know is that only 80% of family child care providers that year even got a correction order. When we looked at it, the average number of violations in that correction order was only one or two. So it's allowing us to put some data into that conversation about whether people are, you know, always getting cited. We're using this tool now with child care centers, so we'll be able to do some similar things. And this slide, I think we were just trying to help understand some of the consistency across counties that we often hear. People are concerned about the consistency, and at least at a high level, if statewide 80% of providers were not having any violations in a visit, we looked at counties based upon their caseload size. And what we found is that there was actually consistency across that. Whether you were in a small county and maybe knew your licensor, whether you think that's good or bad, whether you're in a big county and they have larger caseloads, this, I think, is points to a good solid foundation for how the licensing work is being done, and that we are not seeing major variations at kind of a larger caseload level. So appreciate the time to give you some of that information. Our last slide just talks a little bit about how we've really been trying to respond to some desire for more feedback. We've created something called an implementation plan after each legislative session, where we set out, here's the actual kind of strikeout underline language. Then we say to the provider, plain language, here's what this means. Here's what you need to do to be in compliance. And then we say to the licensor, here's what the change means. Here's how you're going to determine if the provider is in compliance. And it's all in one document. And providers, both centers and family childcare, have generally said that it has been so helpful to have one place where we're talking to both the provider and the licensor about what these legislative changes are. So I think that's just a way to help say we've really been trying to respond to some concerns. We do monthly calls with our county licensors to help get more communication, more kind of situations that have come up, and generalize it across the state, saying this came up in County A. We're thinking that's not the only county. So I think what we do know is we have really increased that both kind of county oversight and collaboration, and are really trying to take to heart how to have an enforcement and compliance system that is also based in some appropriate amount of technical assistance and communication for providers. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Ms. Wagner, thank you so much. That was just terrific. And I learned a ton as somebody who's been studying this the last few years. I still found myself learning just a lot. Members, if you felt like that was an absurd amount of information in a very small amount of time, the blame is entirely on me. It felt like we call it in the legal field issue spotting, where you can at least get at least know what some of the things are out there and then kind of know where you can pursue from there. So I think that this PowerPoint is a very helpful resource to us. Mm-hmm. Members, if in questions, and so I really appreciate Ms. Wagner and also Chris Semple with DHS, and I'm sure many other people involved in pulling this together, because it's a lot more work sometimes to put together a short presentation than a longer one. So especially members, if you have questions and wanting more detail on some of the areas that Ms. Wagner had to really speed through in terms of appeals mm-hmm. or the data analysis, licensing oversight, et cetera, at the end, or anything else, we've got a few minutes for questions before we move on to the second half. So I'll just look to see if we have anybody who has that. And again, we've got, this gives us some good resources in terms of both the PowerPoint and also Ms. Wagner. That was really, really helpful. I'm just looking to see if we do. And no problem if we don't. Oh, Ms. Yes, Representative Franson. Sorry, I'm not quite sure what's happening there, but yeah, go for it. Let's see if we can get you unmuted. There we go.
How long have we been using this thing? Every time I'm on it, I'm like, I don't know how to work the program.
No problem. Representative Franson.
Good morning, everybody. So a question. I just have a question. As the licensors are going out, Reggie, and lovely to see you, by the way, over computer. It's been a long time since we've chatted. I'm just wondering, could you just give the committee just kind of what the morale is of the child care providers out there? I know this has been a very stressful time for them. Could you just fill us in on that and kind of, you know, what they're asking for or what you're feeling out there?
Ms. Wagner.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Franson. And I appreciate the question about kind of the current situation for our child care providers. They have basically done a yeoman's job this past year of really stepping into the designation of critical workforce, having their work highlighted in such a different way. You know, I think that I think the morale is in some ways a mixed bag. They certainly understand the critical role, as they always have. They appreciate the maybe recognition from so many about the way in which they are supporting parents, supporting them as schools were pivoting, trying to assist families that were, you know, going between remote work and stay at home orders and that sort of a thing. So I think it's been very challenging on the one hand for them. They have been obviously just utmost concern for their safety of the kids in care and understanding what COVID is about, trying to understand and adhere to what the guidance is, as well as developing their own best practices and learning from their own peers. You know, I think that they have been impacted by families that have made their own choices as to whether they're going to keep their child in care or not. And so I think that's been a challenge for them, because in some ways it's less about them as the provider and more about how that family is managing that risk. And so that's clearly impacted their businesses. Many of them have chosen to keep their licenses open and kind of see this as a temporary thing. You know, I know you've had some other hearings regarding public support grants and access to some, you know, supplies and protective equipment, you know, whether it's hand sanitizers, you know, gloves, those sorts of things. I know providers have told me that they have felt really appreciated that some of that kind of supply acquisition was being made available even from early on. So I would say that, you know, we always have people that are opening and closing licenses. We're going to start to look at that. When we talk about somebody who closes, we mean that in a very formal, like permanently close their license, they would have to reapply to come back. So there certainly are providers that are perhaps not closing their license, but they may not have children in care. Some we know have chosen to not provide care for a period of time because they have health issues in their own families that they may be managing. So those have been really hard decisions that they have had to wrestle with. But by and large, we have really felt that they have risen to this. Many have said, if I need to take healthcare worker kids, my families have said they'll step back and free those spots up for other kids. So we definitely have seen that kind of community sense of, you know, how can they be part of helping to respond to it? But obviously, it has been challenging with things that they can't control. And so I do think that's made it a little bit difficult for them as well.
Representative Franson.
Yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, members, I used to be a child care provider, and I had just started in, 2006. And it takes a while to get established, right, in this field. And I was new to the area anyway, so that presented issues of its own. And then the housing crash happened, and we went into that major recession. And for providers during that time, it was very tough. I lost a lot of families during that time. And while big businesses were getting bailouts, childcare providers were left on to struggle, close down. And so I just want to thank the body here for supporting family childcare providers and centers during this time. This was not the case in 2008. And even from the federal government, you know, I used to tell my parents when we would discuss this stuff as they were losing their jobs and saying, you know what, all these people are getting their bailouts. Where's the bailout for those of us that have lost their jobs or those of us that are struggling to keep the businesses open, childcare providers open, so that you can continue going to work, et cetera. So I just want to thank, as we move forward, to remember that in order for part of that economy is having family childcare providers at the forefront of the conversation as we get our economy going again.
Thank you very much, Representative Franson. Great points. Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Ms. Wagner, if you could talk a little bit. I know it's different from circumstance to circumstance, but if you could maybe give a couple examples of like what a fix-it ticket would look like versus something more serious, if you have some ideas that you could maybe share with folks. I think, you know, being in this field, I sort of know what they look like, but if you could just give a couple examples of what something at a lower level might look like and what something that's more serious might look like.
Ms. Wagner, yeah. And if you can keep it relatively short, so we just keep moving, but please do that, Ms. Wagner.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Wasilewicz, and I apologize because I don't have like the vetted formal list of what's on there. It is a smaller, narrow list, but I know that one of the ones that providers often talked about, and I'm certain it must be on the list, is, you know, particularly for family child care provider, what if something is too close to the furnace, right? You know, they often can have, you know, things happening in the basement, laundry, that sort of thing, but there are combustible issues around a furnace, right? Well, that's something that they could just quickly move out of the way, okay, and get it back to the minimum, whether it's, you know, 36 inches. We made some changes in updating things with the fire code, so that's probably not the accurate number, but that's an example of, yep, it's technically a non-compliance. You saw it, I saw it, can I just move it, right? That would be something that's easy. The more kind of challenging things are going to be, you know, I've been conducting this interview and you have an infant in there that you haven't checked on once, right? And, you know, is like supervision, like that you're actually observing. Oh, well, let me just go pop in. Well, that's not going to be helpful. So it may not be the most exact one. The supervision ones are so fact dependent too, but really it's a kind of a de minimis non-compliance. We understand why something needs to be a certain number of inches away from something, but it's really not impacting the care of the kids at this moment. And I can easily fix it. That's what that issue was. And things are a little bit less subjective about whether that creates risks or not. So I'm not sure if that's as helpful, and I can certainly get you all the current list of that. We've generally tried to update it each of the last couple of years, but again, with COVID, our work focus hasn't been on that at this point.
I suspect that that would be helpful. I'll turn things back to Representative Wasler, but I suspect that that would be helpful to send out. We can send out to committee members and just some examples of fixed ticket items versus others. But Representative Wasler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that would be helpful for members just to get that information so we have an understanding of what those things are.
Good stuff. Any other questions or comments from members before we turn to our other topic? I'm not seeing anything, but this has been, and again, I know I'm sure it was a ton of work to try to distill this into the short amount of time you were given. And so again, I really appreciate that, Ms. Wagner. I feel like you've given us a solid foundation here for a lot of our remaining work. And so I'm grateful to you. And if you can send that information out to us, that'd be really helpful. And I'm sure we'll be in touch with other pieces as well. So thank you so much again.
Yep.
Really
great.
Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Yep.
Thank you. We're turning to our second topic. As I mentioned, about a year ago, we received an update on the issue of some of the steps taken to address program integrity in the CCAP program, many of which were passed by this legislature in 2019. I'm not sure if Ms. Preston's going to be going first. I think so. And so if you can identify yourself. Ms. Moti, or Inspector General Moti. And so if you can identify yourself then, and please proceed with your with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kalani Moti, and I serve as the DHS Inspector General. And within the Office of Inspector General, we have our licensing division, from which you just heard from Deputy Inspector General Reggie Wagner, our background studies division, a legal area, and as well as our financial fraud and abuse and investigations division, which in a moment you'll hear from Deputy Inspector General Christine Preston. And I appreciate the opportunity to share some information today about the child care program integrity measures that we are pursuing here within DHS. And as Chair Pinto had said, about a year ago, DHS Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson and DHS Director of Management Services Jeff Swanson appeared before this committee to provide an update on the ongoing continuous improvement project in CCAP investigations and share with you the impact of the 2019 legislative changes on our work.
And Inspector General Moti, I'm just going to pause you for a second. There's a little bit of noise in the back. I think maybe Ms. Preston is unmuted. Maybe you can try muting. We just are having some other noise. Maybe I think that's quieter now. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Please continue. Okay. I just want to make sure we can hear you well. Thanks.
Okay. And so today we're here to give a status update on the continuous improvement project and share where the CCAP provider investigations is in 2021 and review 2020 actions and outcomes. So as part of preparing for this hearing today, we do have a 2-page summary document that was provided to the committee members. And I believe is also, Nick is projecting that for everyone to see as well on this. I'm happy to share with the members of the committee that the Continuous Improvement Project has entered the maintenance phase or transition to business owner phase in May of 2020. Business processes and systems for the management of investigation data in CCAP investigations that incorporated enhancements and new requirements provided for in the 2019 legislation were established and have been implemented. A comprehensive CCAP investigations process that focuses on cross-functional collaboration that leverages knowledge and skills, relies on decisions based on data and facts, is now consistently utilized and applied. Like any continuous improvement project, the work is continuous and opportunities to refine and improve are ongoing. Some defined key focus areas allow OIG and the CCAP investigations management staff to track progress and review ongoing compliance with the newly established investigation process, timelines, and record-keeping standards. OIG and CCAP investigations management staff prepared and presented compliance tracking reports to the DHS Office of Continuous Improvement at the 30-day, 60-day, 90-day, and 180-day checkpoints following the shift into the maintenance phase of the project. The final compliance check will occur at the end of the one year of project maintenance. And at this point, I'd like to turn this over to Christine Preston, our Deputy Inspector General for the Financial Fraud, Abuse, and Investigations Division, where the CCAP Investigations Unit is located.
Ms. Preston, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. And actually, before you do, I'll just note for members that what we're seeing on the screen, as was said, was sent out. I also had sent out the handout that was used a year ago that contains a number of the changes that we had approved. I found that really useful at that point, and so I've sent that out to you and posted that on the website as well. But Ms. Preston, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and all members of the committee. My name is Christine Preston. I'm the Deputy Inspector General of the Financial Fraud and Abuse Investigations Division, of which CCAP Investigations is, the CCAP Investigations Unit is housed. It's my pleasure to be here today and present to this committee for the very first time. And I would like to share that 1 year ago, when Deputy Inspector Chuck Johnson and Management Services Director Jeff Swanson presented to you, I was a brand new employee to DHS. I had been on the job for approximately 1 week, and I was as interested in the information that they were presenting to you as you were, because I knew that it was going to guide and lead my work. So I listened with rapt attention.
Welcome. We're glad to have, glad to have you.
Thank you very much. Well, now a year has passed since that presentation was made, and I want you to know that I have been very steeped in the work of CCAP Investigations, the Continuous Improvement Project, and the other equally important work that's occurring within my division. Today, I am very happy to report to you that the CCAP Investigations process, case tracking, quality management practices that have been implemented over the last year are working, and they are producing results. And Nick, if you could project on the document to the second page. Thank you. In 2020, CCAP Investigations closed 217 investigations. By comparison, in 2018, there were 20 cases. As a result of the closed investigations, we sent out 97 warning letters, issued 57 overpayments, or assessed 57 overpayments. 12 cases were referred externally, and there were 2 administrative disqualifications. Not to be overlooked is that more than $1.4 million in overpayments were identified. We also spent a good part of last year, 2020, investigating and conducting attendance record reviews of 314 providers. That is a larger number than what we would typically expect to see on an annual year and on an annual basis, because it included a backlog of records that had been collected but had not been reviewed prior to 2020. The attendance record review process that we use has proven to be a very effective and objective way to audit provider compliance with attendance record keeping requirements as required by statute. Of the 314 attendance record reviews that were completed, 88% of them resulted in a preliminary investigation being opened. 77% of the closed attendance record reviews resulted in an administrative action. As a result of those administrative actions, I want to share that 35 providers to this date have exercised their right to a fair hearing and appealed the administrative actions. And we're really closely monitoring those administrative actions and the hearings and the outcome of the hearings, because that is one gauge that we can use to determine the effectiveness of the investigative processes that we have in place. I will say that to date, we're very pleased and satisfied with the outcomes of the appeals processes that have been issued or the results that have been issued, but we're continuing to watch and refine as needed. I also want to share with you an update on how we are using data and analytics. There has the data analytics work in CCAP Investigations is primarily supported and under the leadership of the OIG data team. So there is some distinction and separation between how data is produced versus how data is created. An overpayment tool was developed by the data team for use by CCAP Investigations that creates consistency in attendance record reviews, the documentation that we use, and the overpayment calculation. That overpayment tool, I'd like to share, during a recent DHS fair hearing, training on the appeals process, a human service judge identified that it's a best practice to submit itemized calculations of the overpayment as evidence, and that's the process that we're using in CCAP investigation. So we're pleased to hear that it's been identified as best practice. The data team has also begun to make data mining referrals to CCAP investigations. Data mining and analytics allows CCAP investigations to be more proactive in identifying and investigating alleged or suspected financial misconduct. And rather than relying solely on referrals and tips made through a hotline, review of attendance records, data mining produces red flag exception reports that we can use as an indicator of improper payments. Finally, with regard to data and analytics, because of the case management system that we have in place, case tracking and routine collection of data, we have an increased opportunity to enhance our data analysis that allows us to review results for irregularities, trends, or specific risk factors. And that will continue to develop as we continue to use and track data within that system. I also want to take a few minutes today to talk about stakeholder engagement, and I would be remiss if I didn't share the work that we have done in CCAP investigations and OIG management to listen and receive feedback from various stakeholders. This is work that will remain ongoing. Over the last year, there has been a significant change in the CCAP investigations process and practices, and we have become increasingly aware that we would have benefited by having improved communication, being more transparent about the processes that we are using, and exploring ways that we can work together with the provider community to improve compliance and program integrity. And so that's work that we're continuing to do. An example that I want to share with you about communication is that providers reported to us that they were both surprised and confused when CCAP investigations began issuing warning letters and assessing overpayments. And based on their feedback, we know that the tone and clarity of the communications could have been improved. So we are taking time to evaluate how to improve the communication. We're actually also considering discontinuing the warning letter process and replacing it with a correction order similar to what licensing is using. The reason for that is a warning letter is not appealable. A correction order is appealable, so it actually would give providers more rights in response to an action taken by CCAP investigations.
Ms. Preston, I just want to pause. I know we have a question, Representative France, and I don't know if it's a clarification or if you want to wait till the end, looking to see.
Just a quick question, more of a clarification.
Sure, Representative Franson.
Yeah, so when discussion about those overpayments were mentioned, were those overpayments collected? And if not, why not? Or how much of it was collected if there was some?
Yeah, I actually had a few questions about those as well. Well, let's get that question answered if we can, Ms. Preston, and then.
Sure, I'm happy. So I specifically put in their overpayments identified because of the appeals process rights that providers have when we issue an overpayment. So we may identify it, we can issue an overpayment, but we're not going to say that it's collected until they've gone through the appeals process. And we have several cases that are in the appeals process right now, and we're waiting to find out the disposition of those cases. So I do not have with me today the exact number that's been collected today, but I would be happy to provide it to you.
Okay, Representative France. Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah, if you can, please provide us with that information, Ms. Preston. And as long as we're talking about those overpayments, I was going to ask later about this, but I guess I'll ask now. Do we know for certain, can you talk about the source of that? I think somebody looking at that might say, oh, that means there's $1.4 million in fraud. Can you talk about like what are the sorts of things that would lie behind overpayments, just so we can kind of understand what that term means?
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. An overpayment can be, particularly when we're talking about an attendance record review, it means that the attendance record did not meet the legal statutory requirements of an attendance record. It didn't hit all the points, including first and last name of the child, check in and check out time for the child, a date that the service was provided. And when those elements are missing, that record does not meet the requirements of law. And that is, if it was billed, and we're only basing this against services that were billed, it's not eligible for billing and payment.
So that would be an indication. So in theory, if it's just if a provider just lists the kids by their first name in the records, then that's and got paid CCAB for that, then that would be an overpayment, and then the money would, you know, they'd have to pay it back.
That's correct.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Sure.
It's concerning, but it's helpful information. Thank you.
Sure. That's directly out of the provider record keeping requirements that are outlined in statute, which are really specific first and last name. Right. So that is what we're basing our review and evaluation on.
No, understood. Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah. And then please, return to the rest of your presentation.
Sure.
We'll go on from there. Thank you.
Sure. And we're wrapping up. I'm also, want to share, we've talked about our engagement with the provider community. I also want to talk about our continued engagement with internal DHS partners, county and law enforcement partners, where we're, you know, gathering to discuss CCAP program integrity concerns, making sure that we have consistent processes established and shared understanding about how to report concerns for investigation and coordinating communication. And finally, I want to talk about the impact of COVID-19 on our work. In order to protect the health and well-being of children, safety of providers and investigative staff, we began limiting our on-site monitoring visits in March of 2020. The timing of this decision happened to coincide with the increased review of attendance records that we were doing, which provided our investigators with ongoing work to identify errors. So that is what we've been focusing on. But I'm also happy to share that during COVID-19, CCAP Investigations has been able to support other DHS program integrity efforts by investigating provider compliance concerns that emerge as a result of the peacetime emergency child care grants and the COVID-19 public health fund supports and grant funding. And we found that the investigative process that we created is very adaptable, and we've been able to use that process to investigate allegations when there is an allegation that a provider provided false or misleading information to DHS with regard to those grant funds. In that case, those cases are being referred to CCAP Investigations.
Thank you. And pardon me, Ms. Preston, Representative Franson's hand went back. Did you hand go back up, or was it another clarification? Representative Franson?
I'll just wait until she's done with the testimony, and then I'll ask.
Okay. Yeah, no, and then okay. I'll call on you. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, Ms. Preston, apologies. Please continue.
No, that's fine. I just want to conclude by sharing with you that, you know, my first year on the job is complete. I have found it to be rewarding. I find that I am surrounded by committed professionals who care about program integrity. They have adapted well to the changed environment because of COVID-19, and they really have proven to be committed to learning and working to achieve and sustain high levels of investigative and data tracking standards that have been put in place. And that is where we're moving forward from at this point, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Preston, thank you. And Inspector General Moti, are we coming back to you, or are you just here for questions? Nope, looks like you're just available. Okay.
I'm available. We're both available for questions.
Wonderful. Good. And Ms. Preston, thank you. I'll just, before I call Representative Franson and anyone else, I just want a note for, I don't know if it'd be Mr. Dem or somebody else, but I may want to pull up at some point in the conversation here that 2020 handout that we had from a year ago. So if you could just sort of do what you need to have that available if we want to do that. So I've got Representative Franson and Bennett and Juergen. So Representative Franson.
Thank you. So just curious here, we've talked a lot about the fraud in past committees. Just kind of wondering how that relationship is going with the BCA criminal investigation team these days.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah, Ms. Preston, yes.
Okay, thank you for asking. So we do have an interagency agreement with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that I believe we have 4 investigators that are funded and staffed to investigate CCAP fraud. We refer cases from CCAP Investigations to them if we think that an administrative action is less appropriate than a criminal investigation. I will also say, and we meet with the BCA once or twice a month to kind of update and check on status of those cases. I believe that they are investigating cases, not exclusively those that are referred by us, but other CCAP cases as well. I feel that the engagement is improving. We're, part of it is I'm new in my role, so we've had to establish new relationships and engage in a different way, but we've kind of gotten our momentum, and I feel like that the engagement is going well and the work is proving to be effective.
Representative Franson.
So if they were asked the same question, they would kind of parrot off of what you had said.
I would hope so.
Ms. Preston?
Okay. Yeah, I would hope so.
Oh, okay.
And then,
Representative Franson, yeah, of course. No, of course,
you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Preston, thank you for being here, too. It's nice to, I haven't formally met you yet, but hopefully we can do that one day.
Yeah, thank you.
And wondering also, to this day, how many cases have been referred to the BCA for criminal investigations?
Ms. Preston.
I am not speaking with the data in front of me, but I believe that there are 12 cases that have been referred at this point. I can verify that number.
And if we can make sure to get that information sent to us in response to that question, we'll get that out to members as well. But
yeah, can I also speak to our relationship with the BCA? One of the things that we're evaluating over the last year that we've had to spend a lot of time contemplating, the administrative actions that have been provided to CCAP investigations as a result of the 2019 legislation have allowed us to act very quickly in response to cases. And so we're having to kind of create a relationship with BCA where we have to determine, is an administrative action where we can act very quickly appropriate, or a criminal investigation which can take longer, and how do those two interact? And so we're still kind of navigating that landscape right now.
And I'll maybe just note, as a prosecutor who works a lot with the BCA, yeah, I can really imagine, Ms. Preston, that's a challenge, because the criminal process can be very long. It's a very high standard. It can sort of like not actually get to where you want to be. Sometimes it's very appropriate, and I say this as a prosecutor, so I'm all in favor. But often that's not going to be the quickest thing, even to shut off funding, et cetera. So that's helpful.
Right.
Representative Franson, though, any follow-up from you?
No.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bennett.
Myself unmuted here. Thank you, Mr. Right. Chair. Just a couple of questions. I have one, and this has been very interesting, by the way, so thank you for the presentation. What is the threshold that's in place before a case is passed to the BCA for criminal charges? That's one of my questions.
We sort of got that tiny bit. Ms. Preston, please.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there is a threshold. I think it's an indicator of what the intentionality was behind the action, not a threshold. If we are concerned that there is a deliberate attempt to defraud the system, and we feel that would maybe be more subject to a referral to the BCA, as opposed to a provider who is not able to understand and comply with the requirements of the CCAP program. And it's the intentionality, which is a hard, I don't know how to define that in a threshold. So it could be a very low threshold in a dot by dollar amount, based on what we believe is intent.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, that's interesting. And I can see where there's nuances there you have to deal with. Second question is how many of the civil penalties, if you know this answer anyway, could or should have been criminal? Are there some civil penalties that really should have been pushed into more the criminal zone, or how does that work?
Ms. Preston.
I don't believe that they are mutually exclusive. And I think that has kind of been in the past, they have been, it's either criminal or it's administrative. And right now I think they're both. And because of the standard of evidence that's required for criminal investigations in my tenure, which is short, I wouldn't say that there are any cases that we should have referred for criminal investigation that we didn't. I feel like we're taking the appropriate action and referring as appropriate.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe I can try one clarification, Ms. Preston, that I could imagine, to Representative Bennett's point and to your point about different paths versus converging, that, if you had a really egregious situation, you clearly want to refer to a criminal path, but you might also want to do the administrative path so you can get the funds cut off right away. And again, the criminal path is long, et cetera. So you certainly want to do it, but that'd be something where you do both. There might be a situation where it's lower level, you go after administrative, it's a little less clear. But then as you work with the provider, you realize, you know, this is actually a lot more serious and a lot more concerning than we thought. We're going to also go criminal. So I think just Representative Bennett, I don't know if that's, I should just pause. Ms. Preston, have I sort of said that accurately? Or can you just comment on what I just said?
You did say it accurately. You said it perfectly right. And what we're trying to determine right now is, would taking an administrative action early jeopardize a criminal investigation if that's the path we wanted to pursue? And so when I say we're trying to kind of work out some of these nuances, that's an example of what I'm referring to. We don't want to jeopardize a criminal investigation if that's appropriate, but we want to move quickly to stop action if we can.
It does seem to me that that relationship point that Representative Francis brought up is so important because, you know, you're really working so closely with those criminal investigators and working that through. And Representative Bennett, I don't know if I was piling on your question. So if
you that was very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Preston, I guess my question is, do we have, with the CCAP fraud that came to light a year or so ago, do we have any an amount or a dollar amount that we know that was fraudulent? I know that a year ago there were talks of $100 million, and I'm just curious if we really know the impact of the fraud that came to light.
Before you answer this question, I just want to clarify, Representative Jordan, I think you're talking about 2 years ago, there were allegations of something like that. Yeah, and then the there was an auditor report, which I guess we can get into, but Ms. Preston, I'll let you answer, please.
Sure. What I would say, it was 2 years ago, and there was a legislative audit report where they investigated this, that the allegations at the time were not substantiated about the volume of fraud that exists. So because they were not substantiated, I wouldn't be able to attach, you know, was there a lower dollar amount that could be present? Not that I am aware of, and not that has been proven by investigation.
And one thing I'll just know, we'll make sure to send out to members, and I'll get back to Representative Juergens. We'll send out the link to the OLA report, really reports, I think, two of them from 2 years ago. So I suppose the allegation was 3 years ago, now that I think about it.
That's right.
It was 2 years ago, that the OLA report found couldn't substantiate the $100 million allegation, found other things, and Representative Juergens will direct you to the report on that. And then so that was, but we'll make sure to get the report out to folks or reports. Representative Juergens, though, follow.
Yeah, time flies, I guess. I can't believe it's been that long already.
Yeah.
And then, so from an ongoing perspective, what, you know, to keep these allegations in front of the public so that they have a means to check on these, what are we doing from a transparency standpoint as far as, are these being published somewhere? How can the public keep track of this?
I will say these questions are doing a pretty good job of keeping the allegations in front of the public, but Ms. Preston, please.
No, thank you. So I would not, our role wouldn't be to keep allegations in front of the public, but one of the things that we have not done in CCAP investigations that we are exploring right now, partly in response to feedback that we've received from the provider community as well as our law enforcement partners, is similar to licensing, actually publish the actions that we've taken and make them available on a website if there's been a warning letter or a correction order, an overpayment or some other action. When the case is closed and resolved and the appeal rights have been exhausted, publishing the results of those activities so that they're much more transparent in the work that's being done and the results of the work.
Representative Juergens.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, helpful. And so we'll go to Representative Pryor and then Representative Franson. I will note, as I said, that we do have the list of some of the changes that have happened in the last couple of years, which Representative Juergens and others may be really helpful just to see what has changed even since those allegations were made several years ago. But Representative Pryor, we'll go to you, and then, as I said, Representative Franson. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Preston, it's just kind of like the details of, you know, as we went through this and actually heard about the continuous process improvement always to be improving the ability to verify our funds that we're using, these public funds. We talked about, I know one of the issues was whether or not all centers used electronic records. And that was, you know, that was one of the things is that, you know, we wanted to see the electronic records because those are easier to verify. But on the other hand, you know, some places didn't have the technology. And So just kind of where did we, and this is my first question, and I have another question after that, if I may, Mr. Chair. Where did we end up with that? Is that now required to use electronic records, or are we still in the process on that?
Ms. Preston.
So I will, go ahead, Kalani, go ahead, please.
Inspector General Moti.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can begin to answer that question. And that work has primarily been led by our Children's and Family and Services Administration, and they did conduct a detailed study and report on electronic verification for attendance records for that. And we can provide, I believe we're getting ready to provide a report back to the legislature on that. And if we have that finalized and it's ready to go out, we can share that with you. I don't believe at this time they are thinking it is plausible because of the costs associated with it. They've had a lot of interactions with the provider community and listening to them on it, but we can provide that information. But there were a few other recommendations that may be more plausible and more doable at this time. So we can provide that to you in the committee as soon as that is made public.
Inspector General Moti, thank you. I think that report was actually sent out, I believe. We'll make sure that it is put in the hands of committee members. Maybe again, if we had done that already, but Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I should check more carefully.
Hold on, one second, Representative Pryor. Sounds like Inspector General Moti, you have something to add.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, sorry about that. I want to clarify, it's not an actual report. I believe it's a memo back to it's a couple page memo back to the legislature. It's not a full blown report, but it does answer all the questions that you did raise, Representative Pryor.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Pryor.
And this is, my second question is on a totally different topic, which is, as I remember too, I mean, it was a great presentation that we had last year, now we're back into years, was about this process improvement. And I know that there were special steps that were about new centers being set up and, being able to partner with them to make sure that they were using best practices. But I can imagine that there's not been a lot of new homes and new centers opened up during the pandemic. So the work that you've been doing then, Ms. Preston, in terms of investigation, partnering with centers to improve their processes, with all the challenges you've had too, are we like doing this in phases where, maybe we can look forward to the opening of, and are we ready to help centers get up and running and using all of the best practices that are available for verifying information and all of those kinds of things? So kind of where do we stand on this? Because we know that this isn't just punitive. This is about people mm-hmm. want to do the right thing, and that we also want to assist them in doing the right thing. So any comments that you have on that right now?
Ms. Preston.
I think what you're referring to, and Deputy Inspector General Reggie Wagner referred to this, the early and often program, which is when programs or our licensed centers are opening within the first year, we're providing them with a higher level of technical assistance, more frequent visits, some announced and unannounced, to guide them through the compliance process. And there is an element of that that involves the CCAP investigations. And one of the visits would include a CCAP investigator, but you are correct that during COVID-19 and kind of the pause on some of the on-site visits that have occurred, the technical assistance and support is happening without the on-site visit necessarily.
Thank you. Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Franson.
Thank you. And just a reminder too, so the OLA is not the in criminal investigator. So the question that Representative Juergens had asked regarding the fraud, right? And then Ms. Preston answered the question. So the OLA does not actually do the investigation. And that report did say that the OLA could not substantiate the amount of fraud. And that's why we have the fraud division. And so Just a little clarification there. So we still would kind of like it. Let's just say we're not talking about previous, but ongoing fraud. Do you have a number that you're working with right now that is related to fraud? And then I also have another question after that.
Yeah, Ms. Preston or Inspector General, Ms. Preston, please.
I don't know that I immediately would have an answer for you to that. Part of what I talked about is our increased ability to do data analytics because we're using a database, because we're collecting data, because we're able to kind of now capture historical behavior and outcomes. That's going to allow us to kind of better extrapolate and understand the potential for fraud and where it's coming from and what the results are. That is, we're in that process, but we have to build the data first and the data sets in order to do that analysis. And that's a work in progress. It will be ongoing and it'll continue to become more robust over time as we continue to collect and analyze data.
And I wonder, and Representative Prince, I wonder if it would be useful, we could either do it now or after your next question, but to take a look at the prior sheet kind of showed where things were and where things are, so we get a sense of that building up. But I'll let you do your second question first. So Representative Franzen.
Certainly. Just to kind of follow up here. And, you know, so I don't think my team would be asking so many fraud questions. We just want the public to just kind of be updated on what's happening. So our questions aren't, I don't want you to walk away from today's hearing, Ms. Preston, for your first time in front of the committee, thinking that we're beating up on you. We just want the public just, you know, they're still asking questions. Are you shutting down, or is the department, not you, shutting down the cash flow to providers where probable cause has been determined via a search warrant, probable cause to commit fraud via the district court?
Ms. Preston.
Thank you for the question. And I have not intended to be evasive in my answers. I am trying to be sensitive to any active cases that we have there where the disposition is not public. But I can tell you that we do have an ability, if there is a search warrant, an active search warrant that outlines or creates a reasonable basis to believe that fraud exists, for us to stop payment to a provider. And we do have the ability to do that, yes.
Is Representative Franzen, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Preston, is that currently happening now? Do you have cases where you have shut down the cash flow?
And Ms. Preston, you know, you have some concerns, I know, with active case, being able to talk about active cases, I assume, just based on my own experience as a prosecutor, I assume that'd be a bit of a concern. But Ms. Preston, can you shed some more light on this as much as you can?
Or actually, I can.
Or Inspector General Mochin, pardon me, please, yeah.
And as of right now, we wouldn't be able to comment and or discuss any open or active cases because under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, it is still considered private information. So we wouldn't be able to fully answer your question today on that. It is part of our processes, and we do work in consultation with the BCA on any of those cases. But at this time, we can't. Speak to any active open investigations.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, so we're all building a new relationship here, right? Since the previous Inspector General is no longer in charge. And so even our committee members are rebuilding a relationship with the department, which I think is great. It's healthy. We all need to get off on a good foot so that we can all work together collaboratively. So how, with that said, how do you plan on engaging with the legislature, engaging with the committee when issues come up? So let's just, we'll go back to 2 years ago. We didn't know about any fraud issues until that explosive report came out, which created a lot of division within the legislature, the public, the department. What is your plan to keep us informed as you see things going on the outside so that we are not all blindsided?
Inspector General Moti.
Um, So as we, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Franzen, as we are going forward and as working with Deputy Inspector General Preston here, we will be looking at how we can be more transparent, when we can be more transparent and share the information that we have and what we're learning on it. There are obviously times when we have active and ongoing investigations where we aren't able to share information, but part of our goals is there needs to be a level of transparency, obviously, in balancing that with you know, moving forward and opening investigations and cases. So we are open and willing to come back and to share the information as we identify it, and as we see the trends, as we're using our data mining on that. And so we are committed to not only sharing that with the legislature, but also with the provider communities and stakeholders as well. So I don't know if I want to move it over to Deputy Inspector Preston, if she has anything else that we can share or anything else that she'd like to share.
Ms. Preston, further on Representative Franzen's question.
The one thing that I would offer, what we haven't talked about, is trends and themes that we're seeing, not just in CCAP investigations in Minnesota, but across the country, and also in other publicly funded programs. And we have opportunities to share with you as we see trends and themes, particularly, I can say, in all fraud investigations in the country right now with regard to public funded programs. There are questions, not a lot of answers, about what's the impact on a lot of the COVID-19 funding that has occurred and waivers and things like that, where rules have changed and how has that impacted fraud. That is it's a question, but we do believe that there will be some trends and themes specific to COVID-19. So that's an example of something that we can be paying, you know, careful attention to and evaluating and sharing what we're seeing or what, you know, the industry is seeing with regard to that type of work. And there will be other trends and themes like that we don't know the answer yet, but we know that there is potential for increased fraudulent activity.
Thank you, Ms. Preston. And we'll want you to keep in touch with us quite a bit. Representative Franzen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Preston, you're absolutely right. So there was a lot of good faith effort brought forward by the administration and the legislature with the flexibilities provided, the financial help provided, and like any situation, there may be some bad actors that take advantage of it, which sullies the entire program. So I thank you for doing your work in making sure that there is integrity on every level.
Representative Franzen, thank you very much. And thanks to these two testifiers. I want to, if we can, and have them hold on for a second. If we can have Mr. Dem, I don't know if you're the one, if you could just bring up that 2020 document. And just in our closing minute here, I especially wanted to direct this to the new members of the committee. Oh, this is actually perfect. Thank you. So especially to, Representatives Bolden and Daniels and Wolgamott and Juergens and Bennett and Chair Dabney. Just to kind of be aware on that left column, and again, those of us on the committee last year will have seen this, but these are kind of some of the reasons that there were some significant concerns as of a few years ago, and you kind of see this on the left, and again, I won't go through detail here, but just I want to make sure that we're all just aware, and then on the right-hand side is some changes that were made. And this is a handout, again, that was sent out to all of us and then posted on the website and, again, used last year. And then, Mr. Dem, if you could scroll down to the second page then. And then we had passed in 2019, those of us in the legislature then, a number of changes on the left column. And then this is some of the steps taken by the department on the right-hand side. And it was really important to me that we have that big update and review a year ago and then this update and review now, because I do take to heart the questions and statements by Representative Franzen and many others that this is an important topic and one we want to make sure that they're really on top of. And so I'm not going to walk through these in detail, but I just want to make sure to direct folks' attention that if you're especially interested in this issue of program integrity, as I know some of the members' questions indicate an interest in that, this will be a really good source for you to kind of see where things were as of a few years ago and the changes since. You can bring us back to the grid. Thanks. And so if you're especially interested in this, I guess I would direct your attention to that document so you can kind of see the steps we've taken. And now we've got a great presentation from from our inspectors general to help us with this. So thank you. Just looking to see if there's any further questions. I'm not seeing any hands raised. This has been a really terrific. Oh, Inspector General Modi, you can't resist. What do you have?
Chair Pinto and members of the committee, I just wanted to let you know that the in the question to Representative from Representative Pryor about provider attendance records and CCAP registration requirements, it was provided to I believe Representative or Chair Schultz in the House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee at the end of January. So we will get a copy of that to you and to all of the committee members on that. That really goes into attendance records, electronic attendance records, and just what they found. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Inspector General. Yes, I noticed that was sent to Chair Schultz, and I have made the request to be directed to the correct committee in the future, but no problem. We've had it sent, and I believe we might have had it sent out to members as well, but if we haven't, we'll certainly make sure to do so. So members, on Thursday, we're going to be hearing from the Department of Education, from MDE, and the same sort of thing that I've really requested an absurd amount of information in a far too short amount of time, but at least to be laying the foundation for us. And I know we've had a lot of foundational presentations, but it's felt like it's really helpful. I'm thinking that then starting next week, we'll be able to really get moving on some bills in some ways that I'm hoping are really both efficient and well-informed. And so we'll ask, I think we had a couple follow-up requests for our inspectors general and for others, if you can, and for Ms. Wagner, if you can get those out to us. And members, thank you so much for your attention and focus. And with that, our meeting is adjourned. We'll plan to see you on Thursday. Thanks so much.